Okay, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:41, and it's May 1st. And we're going to finish up, look at the schedule here. We're going to finish up blood, heart, and circulation, maybe get into cardiac out, blood flow, and blood pressure. All right, so we're going to be done with chapter 13 today, then move into 14. And that's pretty much all I know at the moment. Okay, I don't know what we're going to be able to cover in these other chapters. So you got to keep coming to class to know. But for sure, your last exam is going to be on May 22nd. That's going to be exam number 4. All right. So, anybody have any questions over what we covered last time? What did we look at last time? I did want to mention a couple of things. I wanted to ask you guys some questions. Yeah, I remember now. How do you think about agglutination, if you're going to describe that to somebody at a molecular level? What's agglutination all about? Yes, it's an antigen-antibody reaction. I did hear that from somebody out there. Yeah, very good. Antibody-antigen reaction. And remember, an antibody is like a little guy with two hands, and the hands are receptor sites. They have to match up with an antigen. And it doesn't matter if it's antigen on one of your cells or a bacteria or whatever. Antibodies can attack anything with those antigens. And those antigens have to have the right shape to fit into those receptor sites. Okay. So antibody-antigen reaction for agglutination. What about coagulation? How would you describe that to somebody? What's happening there for coagulation? Coagulation.
Wow, we learned all those steps.
Things over here, and all funneled into this middle thing, and calcium was necessary, phospholipids.
Fibrin formation, perfect. Yeah, fibrin formation. So you realize there's a big difference between antibody-antigen reaction and fibrin formation. What's the molecule that comes before fibrin? Okay. Okay, so not the enzyme that converts something into fibrin. I want to know what is there that allows fibrin to be found in the blood very quickly after a blood vessel is damaged. There's a precursor to fibrin. There's a precursor, but it's inactive. That's what I'm trying to get at. That the inactive precursor to fibrin. Fibrinogen. Yeah, fibrinogen. And whenever you see that ogen, you're going to know that there's plenty of that molecule around, but it's in reserve. It's not acting. It can be converted into an active chemical right away. All right, so those were some of the things that we looked at. What is one really easy way to tell me what it means when somebody is a type A blood type? What does that mean? Again, think at a molecular level. What the heck does that mean? Think of it in terms of antigens and antibodies. Somebody with type A has the A antigen on the surface of red blood cells. Right. And which then means that they have anti-B antibodies in their plasma. Okay. Unless they're type AB, then they don't have any antibodies in their plasma. All right, so those are the things we talked about last time. We talked a little bit about platelets last time, too. Okay, so here is some anatomy. This is, don't fall asleep during this, so I'm going to speed through it fast or maybe not at all because I don't want you guys to fall asleep. Here are the pulmonary and systemic circulations. I guess before we get started here, I'll show you a slide right here, and let's consider the heart. How many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
How many valves does the heart have? Yes, I heard mostly four. That's good. Maybe I heard something else, but I couldn't quite tell. But it's four. That's excellent. And you should know these valves, definitely where they are. They're in two different classes. Can anybody tell me the classes of these four valves? Yeah, there's atrioventricular valves. That's one class. And semilunar valves, right? So there's two semilunar, two atrioventricular. Here are the two atrioventricular valves. And here is a semilunar and, oh, here's an atrioventricular here and here. Here's a semilunar for the pulmonary. Here's a semilunar for the aorta. So that we call that the aortic semilunar valve. Okay, in terms of ventricles, how many ventricles are they? Are there? Two. Can you tell me their names?
left and right ventricles. How many atria are there? Can you tell me their names? Left and right. So that leads me to my next question. How many sides does the heart have? Two. It's got two. It's got a left side and a right side. And so that also tells you how many circulations are in your body. How many major circulations are there? Two, because your heart has two sides, and you got to know their names and what they're doing. So what are the names of these two circulations? Pulmonary is one, and systemic the other. And where does the pulmonary circulation go? To the lungs, right? And it goes to the lungs to get rid of carbon dioxide, or blood goes to the lungs to get rid of carbon dioxide and pick up oxygen. And the other circulation, somebody said, was systemic. The job of the systemic circulation then is to deliver that oxygen to tissues and pick up carbon dioxide from tissues. So that's the job of the systemic circulation. Now, these compounds, oxygen and carbon dioxide, can only diffuse in or out of the blood in a special kind of blood vessel. What is that? Yeah, that's a capillary, right? So if something is in an artery, it's stuck there. Can't get in, nothing can get out, right? If something's in a vein, again, whatever in the blood is just stuck there. Can't get out, and nothing can get into a vein either, right? So there is only oxygen and carbon dioxide and other nutrients diffusing through capillaries. And so I guess that was a question I wanted to ask you. How do these compounds move in and out? I just said diffusion, which means what? What is really the force that's driving that? Concentration gradient. Yeah, exactly right. So we see here here's pulmonary circulation. We have oxygen moving. Is this right? Wait a second. Oxygen, this is wrong, isn't it? Which way should oxygen go? This should go from the lung into the blood. Oh, here are the lungs. Oh, that's just the brain. That's part of the systemic circulation. Okay, here are lungs. Thank you. Here are the lungs. So we got oxygen moving into the blood. Okay, you said by concentration gradient. So where is oxygen higher? In the blood or in the air that's inside the lungs? Air that's inside the lungs. Otherwise, it wouldn't diffuse in. All right, and then here we have some cells down over here in the systemic circulation, and we have oxygen diffusing from the blood into these cells. So where do you have high oxygen concentration? In the capillaries, and it's low in the cells. Otherwise, oxygen just would never go in there. All right, so that, once you think about it, that seems like it's kind of a strange concept. So we have oxygen in the air, we have oxygen in our cells. Where is there high oxygen? Where is the oxygen high? Air or cells? It's got to be high in air, otherwise oxygen wouldn't diffuse in. All right? So even though you think cells have to have a lot of oxygen, in terms of a relative sense between the atmosphere and cells, the atmosphere is still higher nonetheless. Same thing for carbon dioxide. Where is carbon dioxide higher, in cells or in the air? Carbon dioxide high is where it's coming from, which is cells. And it's low in the air. Otherwise, carbon dioxide would never diffuse out of your body. All right, so make sure you know all these chambers, structures of the heart, the valves. What are the names of the atrioventricular valves here and here? As a matter of fact, this one right here. Yeah, that's a tricuspid, right? And that's on the right side. Here is the bicuspid. Remember, you try before you buy. And then these are the semilunar valves. All right, so that's a really handy figure. Make sure that you can draw that out. Okay, structure of the heart, I'm not going to go over any of that. That stuff you all know. Systemic circulation. Now, here's something that I don't go over in anatomy. Maybe you haven't realized this either, but you told me that there's a right side and a left side to the heart. And guess what? You're exactly right. So the heart is one organ, but it's really two pumps that are side by side. All right, there's one pump that pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation, here and here, and there's another pump, the left ventricle, pumps blood through the systemic circulations. So there are actually two pumps. So this means that in order for this cardiovascular system to work, the amount of blood pumped by the left ventricle over a relatively short period of time has to equal the amount of blood that is pumped by the right ventricle.
So that's what this thing says right here. Rate of flow through the systemic circulation must equal the rate of flow through the pulmonary circulation. So just memorize that. But why is that? If you understand why, then maybe it won't be so hard to remember. All right, let's just say that the systemic circulation is pumping more blood than the pulmonary, or that the left ventricle is pumping more blood than the right ventricle. So what does that mean? Well, that means that some blood is going to back up in one of these places, which would be the lungs in this particular case, if the right ventricle wasn't pumping the same amount as the left ventricle. And if that were to continue, what would happen to the lungs? They'd get bigger. They get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then finally explode. All right, so we don't want that to happen. Your body goes under a lot of different methods to make sure that the ventricles pump the same amount of blood, right? Because we don't want blood backing up, pooling in one spot or the other. All right, so and then if we look at this slide over here, right, we see the systemic circulation. You should actually realize that it's not just two capillary beds, like there are two capillary beds in the pulmonary circulation right here, that the systemic is everywhere in the body except the lungs, right? So this is a huge area, huge volume compared to the volume of the lungs, which means that the vessels for the pulmonary circulation are relatively short. The vessels for the systemic circulation have to be relatively long, and probably in lab you realize that the length of a blood vessel is determining what? What does the length of a blood vessel determine? It determines blood flow, because the length of the blood vessel determines the resistance. And if you make the blood vessel shorter, or any kind of tube shorter, the resistance goes down. So here is a nice equation that you should never forget. And this is blood flow. What is blood flow determined by? So it's going to be directly related to something and inversely related to another thing. So it's directly related to what? What's moving a fluid around, like blood? It's pressure. All right, so we've got pressure right here. You can put down blood pressure if you want. So if we increase pressure, we increase flow. Nice linear relationship. But there's something that will decrease the blood flow that can change in your body as well. Okay, viscosity is one thing, but you know what? I hope our viscosity of our blood doesn't change very much. All right, so that's not, it might if you're exercising for like 10 hours and you don't replace fluids and you sweat all that fluid out, your blood does get more viscous. That could be dangerous, but typically that doesn't happen. Usually you get an impulse to drink something, and that brings the viscosity back to where it should be. But if you were to change the viscosity, you're right. Right, the resistance would change. What's another thing? Yeah, the diameter of a blood vessel. And that's how your body regulates blood flow, okay? Because you can vasoconstrict or vasodilate arterioles very easily, and that's a one way to adjust flow in a part of your body. We're going to look at that in the next chapter. So you guys are good. You're seeing all some of the important pieces, and it is the length of a blood vessel. Okay, so as a blood vessel gets longer, the resistance increases. And guess what? Your body can't regulate that. The length of all your blood vessels is pretty much fixed, but what you do see here in comparing the pulmonary and systemic circulation, the blood vessels for the pulmonary circulation are short. The blood vessels for the systemic circulation are a lot longer, which means which one has more resistance? So resistance, right, is going to be proportional to the length of a blood vessel. And you see that the systemic blood vessels are a lot longer, so what can you tell me about the resistance for the systemic circulation? It's really high. That's right. It's really high. So this is a big number. But we said that the pulmonary and systemic circulations have the same flow, right? So if the resistance of the systemic circulation is increased compared to the pulmonary, how does your body maintain the same flow as the pulmonary circulation if resistance is increased and we want to keep flow the same? What else has to change? The pressure has to go up, right, to compensate for an increase in resistance. So if we increase both of these, then the flow stays the same. And the flow in the right side of the heart have to stay the same, right? But we said that pulmonary resistance is low, systemic is high. If the flow is the same, then the pressure in those two circulations are different. And since the resistance is high in the systemic circulation, then the blood pressure is a lot higher in the systemic circulation compared to the pulmonary circulation. So that's something for you guys to think about, because we hardly ever think about pulmonary blood pressure. It's hard to measure, and we don't pay much attention to it, because if we're going to measure systemic circulation pressure, we can just put a cuff around somebody's arm, and all these blood vessels in your arm belong to what circulation, pulmonary or systemic? Yeah, systemic. So it's easy to measure systemic circulation, but if we want to measure blood pressure with that same method, the auscultatory method of the blood vessels in the lungs, where would we have to put that cuff to pump up? Way inside your body, right? Like around the lung or around the pulmonary artery. And guess what? Can't get to it. So that's really a mystery under most circumstances. So we're very familiar with systemic pressure, but not so much for pulmonary. But now you have a little sense that the pulmonary pressure is a lot less compared to the systemic. Okay, the other thing that this slide right here shows, well, it does say what? Resistance in the systemic is a lot greater than pulmonary. So in order to keep flow the same, work done by the left ventricle is 5 to 7 times greater because it's a much longer circuit. And because the left ventricle is working harder, guess what happens to the muscles compared to the muscles on the right side of the heart? So you walk around all day for a couple months, flexing your biceps, what's going to happen to the biceps? It's going to get bigger and thicker and stronger, right? Same thing for the left ventricle. Since it has to do more work, it is bigger and thicker when you look at it, 3 to 4 times thicker. You probably did a dissection and saw that. Okay, and now you sort of know why that is. All right, here are those atrioventricular valves. Not going to talk about them, but make sure you know something about chordae tendineae, papillary muscles, and the semilunar valves, where they are. And I don't know if you knew this, I don't know if it's so important in this class, but you know the layers of the heart. It's not on any of these slides, I don't think, but how many layers are there? I don't want to know about in terms of a serous membrane, the components of a serous membrane. I just want to know layers of the heart wall right here. So let's start on the outside and go into the heart. What's the first layer we bump into? Epicardium. Right, epicardium. And then we bump into the myocardium, and guess what? We got to bump into another layer before we leave the wall of the heart, and that is the endocardium, right? So the endocardium, just like in a blood vessel, we call that an endothelium, but in the heart we call it an endocardium, is very thin, and it's smooth and slippery. Why do you think maybe it should be smooth and slippery as opposed to rough and jagged? Yeah, because these rough surfaces can cause a blood clot, and we don't want blood clots in a normal circulation, right? So if there's a blood clot being generated by the heart, right, then it could go to the brain, go anywhere in your body, and cause an infarction in the heart or brain or any of those other places. So it's a smooth, slippery surface. And here's the point that I wanted to get to. The thing that makes up the valve itself is endocardium. Right, it's just endocardium. There's no muscle in it whatsoever. So these valves work passively. There's no active involvement in opening and closing these valves because it's made up of endocardium. And then the other thing, you should tell me, what about the surface of all these valves? Smooth and slippery. That's not necessarily always the case. Right, they can be damaged, in which case they'll turn rough and they might have plaques on them and they won't open and close quite as much as they should, and they could even generate clots. Okay, so that's some of the basic things that you should know. Make sure you review your anatomy on that. All right, let's talk about the cardiac cycle. And this is called the cardiac cycle because the heart is pumping blood, but only part of the time. It's not like an electric motor, which is turning all the time and pumping some kind of fluid all the time. Sometimes the heart is pumping blood, and sometimes the heart is relaxing. And both of these phases are real important. They're short phases, right, so your blood pressure really doesn't drop, but since the heart is a muscle, it contracts, and then it has to relax, and then it contracts again, and when it contracts, it's pumping. When it's relaxing, it's filling with blood, and that filling phase is really important because if that filling phase isn't operating properly, what can you tell me about the pumping phase? if no blood gets into the heart, even though the heart is ready to pump and can pump vigorously, if there's no blood there, then it's not going to pump any blood or a reduced volume of blood, right? So those two parts of the cardiac cycle are important. We call these different phases. There's systole for contraction and diastole for relaxation. Both of these, if there is diastole pathology, then blood can't get into the heart, which means then that the heart can't pump blood, and systole is going to be abnormal as well. All right, so you got these two phases. Both atria contract simultaneously, followed by the ventricles a little bit later, just a split second later, because the job of the atria is to pump just a little bit of blood into the ventricles. And if the ventricles were contracting at the same time, then the atria couldn't force any more blood in the ventricles because the atria are really small. Maybe you've looked at the an atrium and it has a very thin wall, and that sort of makes sense because how long is the tube between an atrium and a ventricle compared to another circulation like systemic or pulmonary circulation? What's the distance between an atrium and a ventricle? Oh, it's really, really short, less than a millimeter, right? So so the atria don't have to produce or generate a lot of force because it doesn't have to pump blood a very long distance, right? It's almost a microscopic distance. Well, you can see it with your naked eye. So the heart does contract in a coordinated fashion, the atria followed by the ventricles. So since we said the systemic circulation has a much higher resistance, look, it has a much higher blood pressure. All right, so here is the blood pressure in the systemic circulation under normal conditions, 120 over 80 millimeters of mercury. Right, that's just a measurement of pressure. We could put PSI here if we wanted or other units of measurement, but in clinical realm, we usually say millimeters of mercury. And the pulmonary blood pressure is probably even less than 25 over 10 millimeters of mercury. All right, so could you understand why the pulmonary blood pressure is so low? Why is it so low compared to systemic? Because it's so shorter, that's right. And since the length is shorter, it has less resistance. So in order to keep flow the same, the pressure has to be reduced in the pulmonary circulation. Okay, so diastole is what kind of phase again? That's when the heart contracts. Diastole is when the heart is relaxing. All right, let's look at some definitions. End-diastolic volume. So this is after the heart fills with blood, right? It's right at the end of diastole, right at the end of relaxation. And we would like to know what that volume is. That's an important volume to know. And also, we would like to know the end systolic volume. And that is at the end of systole, after the heart contracts. So I want you to kind of think, which one of these volumes is bigger, end diastole or end systole? End systolic volume or end diastolic volume? Which one is bigger? Okay. Yeah, I always used to think, before I opened up the book and actually studied it, I used to think end systolic volume was bigger, right, because that's where the most pressure is. But remember, end diastolic volume happens after the heart relaxes and fills with blood. So that's actually the largest volume inside of a ventricle. End diastolic volume is big. End systolic volume is small because why? The heart contracts and the volume of the ventricle decreases. And if we wanted to find out how much blood is pumped by the heart when it goes from diastole to systole, because that's really the amount of blood that's going to be flowing through our body, how could we calculate that if we know end diastolic and end systolic volumes? We would just subtract end systolic volume from end diastolic, and we would get the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it beats, every time it contracts, or at least from that one ventricle. That is also an important measurement, and we call that stroke volume. Right? So stroke volume is the amount of blood ejected from the ventricles during systole. And that's just the difference in these two volumes, end diastolic and end systolic volume. That's stroke volume. And so that stroke volume is related to the strength of the heart. As the heart gets stronger, stroke volume increases. As it starts to fail, stroke volume gets less, and that's because the end systolic volume gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and a lot of blood is left inside the heart. All right, so make sure that you're really familiar with this question. Which is larger, ESV or EDV?
The biggest one is EDV, end-diastolic. That's after the heart relaxes. What is SV? What's the stroke volume if end systolic volume is 20 and end diastolic volume is 80? Can you see that? Yeah, it's pretty easy, right? You just subtract the two, and that will tell you what the stroke volume is. As the heart gets stronger, the stroke volume increases. The stroke volume increases, which means that the end systolic volume gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And if it goes to zero, then the end diastolic volume is really the whole volume that is pumped from the heart. Yeah. Oh, I couldn't quite hear. Beats per minute. It has to do with blood flow and blood pressure. And they have a bigger heart. Certainly they have a bigger stroke volume as a result of that because their hearts are bigger and stronger. Okay. So, because they have a stronger and bigger heart. So their stroke volume is higher, so that means their heart doesn't have to work quite as much. So their heart rate is slower as a result. Okay. Does anybody in here have a heart rate, say, in the 50s when you're resting? 50s? Ah, that's good. That means your heart is not working very hard at all. That's excellent. So are you an athlete? No, it just happened to be that way. Okay. All right, so we can see that sometimes the heart is contracting, sometimes it's relaxing. That's what we call the cardiac cycle. And I want you to be really familiar with all of these things on the slide right here. This is what we call a Wiggers diagram. This is not the exam figure for you, so I'm going to switch over to the exam figure very quickly. It's the one that's in your lab manual. But what is this a graph of, right? So I see a couple graphs right here that are all superimposed on each other. So we have blood pressure on one graph versus time. And then another graph, we have volume versus time of some chambers inside the heart. And then we have electrical activity on the surface of the body. We call that the electrocardiogram. And on this slide, we also have the sounds that your heart makes versus time. And these are all justified so that they're all happening at the correct time. And so what do we see, at least on this slide? We see systole. What is systole followed by? Diastole. And what is diastole followed by? Another systole. On and on and on and on. So this thing right here could be reproduced over here just as well. All right, so where is the exam figure that I would like for you guys to know? Well, let me find it. I think I have it opened up someplace. Nope. Here. All right, it's just the one that's in your textbook, but I modified it just a little bit. Let's put it on both screens so that it's clearer to see. But we still have the same axes. We have pressure versus time. We have volume versus time. We have millivolts, which is what? Electricity on the surface of your body, voltage on the surface of your body versus time. And then we have sounds that your heart makes versus time. And all these things have a special relationship to each other. Well, what have we talked about so far in terms of the heart? We talked about pressure a little bit, but we just got done talking about volume, right, of the ventricle. So what we're going to be looking at here is the volume of, let's just say, the left ventricle. Maybe it says in your book someplace. So here we have a large ventricle. The volume is very large, and then it decreases and it goes down to this level right here. What's happening as the volume of the heart is decreasing? What's actually causing that decrease in volume? Yeah, contraction of the heart, right? Systole. So when the heart contracts, the volume of the ventricle gets smaller. So here we see a large volume of a ventricle, and here we see a small volume during the cardiac cycle. So what would we call P? Okay, P is right before systole, which means right at the end of diastole. So this is the end diastolic volume, and we said that is the large volume. And Q over here is, of course, less. You can see that it is less, and it's the lowest volume for the ventricle. So this is the end systolic volume. All right, so if we were to subtract these two things, P from Q, then we would get the stroke volume of the heart every time it beats, because this is just one beat. All right, so
Do you see that on this diagram? Because we kind of considered that already. So here's end diastolic volume, end systolic volume. I see a little blip right here, and this just tells me that the atria have contracted and have pumped a little extra blood into the ventricles. That's what this little blip right here means. Okay. Let's look at some pressures. We got a lot of nice pressures on this graph. All right, so here's pressure versus time. This dotted line right here represents blood pressure in the aorta. And what did you know? What have we just talked about in terms of normal blood pressure in an artery, in your systemic circulation, right? Because the aorta is in your systemic circulation. What's a normal? Yeah, 120 over 80, right? And so we give two numbers because we want to know what the systolic pressure is and what the diastolic pressure is. It's not just a constant pressure because your heart's not beating all the time. So do we see 120 over 80 here? Here is the dotted line. Here's the maximum blood pressure. And if we were to read it off the graph, what do we see? 120. Are you shocked? No, you shouldn't be, right? Because this is under normal circumstances. All right, and then the pressure starts to decrease, and it decreases, and then right before systole, right, it decreases to this point over here. And what's the pressure in the aorta right at this point here? 80. Are you shocked? No, because that's just a normal value, right? 120 over 80, normal blood pressure for systemic circulation. Well, so that's an artery. We want to know what the pressure looks like inside of a ventricle as well. All right, and I see it by this solid line. This is the pressure inside the left ventricle, and you can see that it goes from zero, right at the end of systole, during diastole, there's no pressure inside the left ventricle, but when it starts to contract, right, then the pressure starts to increase, and the heart is a very strong muscle, rapidly increases the pressure inside the ventricle, and it goes up to about 120 millimeters of mercury. And then when the heart starts to relax, what does it do? Go back down to zero. All right, so this is ventricular pressure. I see one more pressure curve over here. And this is pressure of the left atrium. It's a much weaker muscle, doesn't produce a lot of pressure, but it does change a little bit. Most of the time, it's very close to zero. When it starts to contract, the pressure increases just a little bit. All right. And then we saw the volume over here. So let's just consider these pressure curves. So you told me that there are four valves in the heart, right? There's atrioventricular and semilunar. Let's only consider the bicuspid valve and the aortic semilunar valve because we're looking at the left side of the heart. And we also said that the valves don't have any muscles, so they can't close or open on their own, right? They close and open on their own only on the basis of the difference in pressure between either side of the valve, either pressure in the aorta and pressure in the ventricle. All right, so what's the valve between pressure in the aorta and pressure in the ventricle? What valve is right there? I worded that really strange because I worded it more in terms of a physiology question, but I'm asking you for an anatomy answer. All right, so you got to do a little translation. Okay, so what's the valve between the aorta and the left ventricle? That's another way of asking that. That's the aortic semilunar valve. Yeah. Okay. And that aortic semilunar valve will open up only when the pressure in the ventricle is greater than the pressure in the aorta. Otherwise, it's going to be closed. And you can see sometimes these pressures switch around, which means that aortic semilunar valve opens and closes at different times. And it's not due to any kind of muscle, it's just due to this difference in blood pressure from the aorta into the left ventricle. We see crossovers of blood pressure as well in the atria and the ventricle. So here is pressure in the ventricle, here's pressure in the atrium. So if there is what's higher pressure? The atrial pressure, which I see right here, or ventricular pressure? What's higher, atrium or ventricle? Right in this segment right here. Okay, it's atrial pressure, not a whole lot greater, but it certainly is greater. So if it's greater in the atria than the ventricle, which way is blood going to flow? It always goes from high to low, so blood is going to flow from an atrium into a ventricle. And if that's happening, then that atrioventricular valve can't be closed. Right, so it's going to open up. When does that atrial ventricular valve close? When the pressure in the ventricle becomes greater than the pressure in the atrium. Blood is going to want to flow back from the ventricle into an atrium, but it can't because what's there? There's a valve there that makes sure that blood flows through the heart only in one direction. Right, so when pressure in the ventricle increases above atrial pressure, then that atrial ventricular valve closes right here, right at that crossover. Right. So now we see an increase in pressure in a ventricle, and something happens right here. The pressure in the ventricle is now greater than the aorta. Remember, there was a valve here. What valve did we say was right here that was operating? Yeah, the semilunar valve, right? It was closed before, so now it opens up, and then the aorta can receive blood from the ventricle, and the pressure inside the aorta increases. All right, so let's follow this down a little bit more. All right, so now the ventricular pressure, after it's pumped out a bunch of blood from the ventricle, the pressure inside the ventricle starts to decrease, and then the heart even starts to relax during this phase, and the pressure between the aorta and the ventricle switches once again. So right at this point in time, I see that there's higher pressure in the aorta and lower pressure in the ventricle. Which way is blood going to want to go? High to low, which means from aorta to ventricle. But under normal circumstances, does blood go retrograde from the aorta into a ventricle? No, it should not, which means then that this valve right here closes. And this is the aortic semilunar valve. So the aortic semilunar valve opens here because of that pressure difference, and it closes here again because of that pressure difference that switches around. And that's what opens up the and closes the semilunar valves. So if these are the semilunar valves over here, guess which ones are right here? These are the atrioventricular valves. Right? And so the atrioventricular valve closes when the pressure in the ventricle is greater than pressure in the atrium. It closes. So here's closure of the bicuspid valve. And the opposite thing happens here. The pressure in the ventricle is below the pressure in an atrium. So now the atrioventricular valve opens up. That would be the bicuspid or mitral valve. So this closes, it opens. The semilunar valve opens and then closes. All right, so which one of these things happens first according to this diagram? What happens first? What valve closes first? Okay, here is the atrioventricular valve moving before this one, of course, before this one and before this event over here. So this is the first event, and what can you tell me? What's happening right here? We just talked about it, but see if you can kind of think about what's happening by looking at these pressure curves. Right at this point, pressure in the ventricle is higher than the atrium. Which way will blood want to go if pressure is high in a ventricle compared to atrium? It's going to want to go to the atrium. Aha, but can it? No, and it shouldn't, and it can't because what happens here? The atrioventricular valve closes. And when it closes, it slaps together like that, the valve leaflets slap together, and guess then what you can hear? A heart sound. So the first heart sound is due to what event? Closing of the atrioventricular valves, right? Valves usually don't make a whole lot of noise when they open, but they make a whole lot of noise when they close, right? When you open a door, does it make a lot of noise? Slam a door closed, it makes a lot of noise. First heart sound due to closing of the atrioventricular valve. When it opens, doesn't make much of a sound. So the second heart sound, these are the two easiest to hear all the time. Do you think a second heart sound should be due to opening or closing of the semilunar valves? Closing, yeah, absolutely closing. All right, so this first, so these are both semilunar valves right here, but at this point, okay, at this point, the pressure is higher in the ventricle and lower in the aorta, which means blood is going to want to go from the ventricle into the aorta. Is that a good thing? Yeah, because the heart wants to pump blood. Pumps blood into the aorta. That valve shouldn't be closed, because if it was closed, blood couldn't move. All right, so at this point, the semilunar valve opens, but we said, oh, when a valve opens, doesn't make much noise, right? And then we get over here, and we see now the pressure in the ventricle is less than the aorta.
blood is going to want to go from aorta back into the left ventricle, but can it do that? No, because what's in the way? What happens? The semilunar valve closes, right? And remember, that's when those valves make noise, and that's what produces the second heart sound. So you're going to have to probably look at this graph a couple times until you're just familiar with what the first heart sound and what the second heart sound is, and after you look at it a bunch of times, it will make sense. It's just not an exercise in memorization, okay? I don't want you just to memorize. You should really know what's happening here. Okay. There's a couple spaces that I need to talk about because we talk about it in the book. This is when... Oh, what is this right here? What valves are down over here? The atrioventricular valves. All right, so this atrioventricular valve is going to make a noise. So what is it doing here? It's closing. All right, and at this point in time, the semilunar valve hasn't opened just yet. So the heart is contracting, but since both of the valves are closed, all the doors to this particular chamber are closed, the volume cannot change. The muscle is contracting, and it's putting more pressure on the blood inside that chamber, but the blood, no blood can enter, no blood can leave, which means that the volume of that ventricle doesn't change. And we see that right here. Right? Does it look, do you see that the volume is constant? It's not changing. So we call this a period of isovolumetric contraction. The heart is contracting, you know that, because the pressure is increasing. But since all the valves are closed, the volume is actually the same. Can't change. And so isovolumetric contraction. That's a little subphase of systole. There's a subphase of diastole as well. And again, that's when a period of time right here, okay, we see in this location, the heart is starting to relax, right, because the pressure is decreasing. And at this point in time, right, where is that point in time? Oh, here. From here to here. This is when the semilunar valve closes, right? That's the second heart sound. That's when the semilunar valve closes. The heart is relaxing. The volume is staying the same. We can see that on this graph right here. The pressure is decreasing. So the pressure is decreasing. The volume is staying the same. This is what we call isovolumetric relaxation. Isovolumetric relaxation means isovolumetric means what? No change in volume. Isovolumetric here, no change in volume. And this is contraction, here is relaxation. Okay. So use all of these little letters here. Oh, this is the key. Take these letters right here, match it up to what's happening on that graph. And remember, these valves open and close only because of pressure differences that across the valve in one chamber or one artery and the other. Okay, no muscles in arteries. So if I asked you, what is the stroke volume of this particular heart at this particular time, could you tell me what the stroke volume was? Oh, that would be a really good test question. What's the stroke volume of this particular, on this case right here? Okay. I tell you what, just tell me how you would do it. How would you do that? Okay, speaking a little softly, I can't quite hear. Well, how would you go about doing it? And then we'll look at the axis to get some numbers and see if we can do that. How would you calculate stroke volume? I tell you what, do you see a volume? Do you see a curve for volume of the ventricle here? Yeah. Where is it? Right here. Here's volume. So stroke volume is a volume. I would use this curve to figure out what it was. What do we need? We just need two numbers to figure out the stroke volume. End systolic volume and end diastolic volume. So here is end diastolic volume. That's the big volume. Here is end systolic volume. That's the smaller one. So we just subtract these two numbers, and we can then calculate stroke volume. So you probably wouldn't even need a calculator for that, right? You just need the knowledge to know what to subtract and how to read this graph. So what would it be? It looks like maybe it's 110, and it's milliliters, 110 milliliters, and here, what does this look like? Maybe 45. I see a 60, so 45. So 110 minus 45 would be the stroke volume in terms of milliliters. Okay, so that's how you do this from the graph.
The last thing, the only thing we haven't talked about on this graph, sometimes this is called a Wiggers diagram. I never learned it like that, but people are calling it a Wiggers diagram now. Probably somebody named Wiggers had something to do with it. Here is a measure of voltage on the surface of your body, and we can see it's not constant, it is changing. And you know something about cells, when they become excited, what happens? Do they depolarize or repolarize or what? Yeah, they depolarize. So these blips right here represent depolarization in different parts of the heart. All right, so you said that there were basically two kinds of chambers, atria and ventricles. Which one contracts first? Do they contract at exactly the same time? Atria first, then ventricles. So this first depolarization that I see right here is the signal for, or depolarization of, the cells inside the atrium. And that depolarization has to happen first before contraction takes place. So this thing right here is what we call an electrocardiogram. Electrocardiogram is a measure of the electrical events in the heart, but it really doesn't have to do with contraction. It's not tension, right? It's not pressure. This is just the signal for contraction. So you can see that the atria get a signal here to contract, and then there's a little short period of time, and then there's another big signal right here, and this is a big signal because the ventricles have a lot more cells in them. They produce a bigger electrical change on the surface of your body. So this here represents depolarization of the ventricles. So P wave. This first wave right here, depolarization of atria. Why do you think they call this the P? If you have to do a Google on that, let me know. Probably because it's what? Primavera wave. That's as good a guess as anything. Probably that's how it got named P, right? So here's the first wave, depolarization of the atria, followed by the QRS complex, and that is depolarization of the ventricles. All right, so we got depolarization. What happens after depolarization? Does the cell always stay depolarized? No, it goes back down to RMP. How does it get back down to RMP? What's that process called? Repolarization. And when the heart repolarizes, it causes an electrical change on the surface of your body, and I see it right here. And we call that the T wave. So P, QRS, and T. T represents repolarization of the ventricles. Alright, so that's pretty much the whole ECG. Except, what didn't we talk about? We talked about depolarization of the atria, depolarization of the ventricles, and repolarization of the ventricles. What haven't we talked about yet? Repolarization of the atria, right? Because the atria have to repolarize before they can depolarize again, like what I see over here. Well, the atria repolarize at the same time the ventricles depolarize, and those two signals are mixed together and you can't separate them. So the QRS complex is really what? Depolarization of the ventricles and a little component of repolarization of the atria. But it's a really small contribution to the QRS complex. But that's when the atria repolarize. All right, so that's the last event. All right, so practice with this thing, analyze it, talk about it with your friends. Ask each other to calculate stroke volume, and even try to stump your SI leader, okay? So ask a lot of good questions on this right here. Okay, yeah, question. Don't pick on the SI leader, is that what you're going to say? Okay. Sound?
Oh, no, for the pressure.
Here. Absolutely. Oh, do I know? Do I know? No. I think someplace I read they're just going to pick one side of the heart. Oh, yeah, I know. Because the ventricle on the left side is going to pump, and generate a whole lot more pressure than the right ventricle. Right, so if this was right ventricle and I have pressure of the ventricle, it would only go up to 25 and then go down. Okay, and then go up to 25, and then down. So since this pressure goes all the way up to 120, okay, that's got to be the left ventricle. But by looking at where these valves open and close, you can't, because both atrioventricular valves open and close at the same time. right, or the atrial ventricular valve on both sides of the heart close at the same time, and the semilunar valve on both sides of the heart closes at the same time as well. Otherwise, you would have, for this first heart sound, you'd hear two different beats, right? But those valves close together and make only one sound. Semilunar valves close right here, together, make only one sound. Yeah. So the stroke volume of the right ventricle, stroke volume would have to be pretty much the same, right? Because the flow through the pulmonary has to equal the flow through the systemic circulation. Okay, so maybe come to me during office hours and talk to me about this thing. Or sit down with somebody and show them what that graph is all about. You definitely have to talk about it with somebody, right? Because I'm not sure it will really sink into the correct degree. Oh, and look, here's a graph. Isovolumetric contraction, isovolumetric relaxation. Isovolumetric just means all the valves to the heart are closed. Nothing can move in and out of a ventricle, but the ventricle is still contracting and changing the pressure, whether it's increasing or decreasing. All right, well, we talked about these heart sounds already, right? The first heart sound, how are you going to figure that? You can look at a Wiggers diagram, maybe just memorize it, but that's when the AV valve closes. Second heart sound is when the semilunar valves close, both of them together, right? Both semilunar valves or both atrioventricular valves. All right, so another good question to ask is, why do these atrioventricular valves close at a particular time producing this sound? You should be able to verbalize that. Why does this AV valve close? The hint is it has to do with pressure, right? These valves don't have muscle, they can't contract. What's happening in terms of pressure inside the heart that makes this AV valve close, okay, at a particular time to make this sound? Because pressure is what? Pressure is increasing in the what chamber or blood vessel? Pressure is increasing in the ventricle compared to the atrium, so blood is going to want to flow back into an atrium. But this AV valve closes, and it can't. All right, so right at the beginning of, and what do we call a contraction? Right at the beginning of, okay, we learned two words for relaxation and contraction. So this AV valve closes right at the beginning of, systole, because that's when the pressure inside the left ventricle increases, right? Both AV valves, all right? And the second heart sound is when the semilunar valves, both semilunar valves close. Why does that happen? Again, it's got to be due to a pressure change, right? When the pressure becomes higher one place compared to another, these semilunar valves close, right? That's just a doorway to a ventricle. When should that doorway close in terms of the semilunar valves? So we're talking about aorta versus left ventricle. When should that door close? When should that door open? That door should open when during systole, so the heart can pump blood, right? If that semilunar valve doesn't open, then the ventricle can't pump any blood. So it closes because now there is higher pressure in the aorta compared to the ventricle. That means blood would flow from aorta into a ventricle, and that would eventually kill the heart because it would have to work way too hard. So that's the closure of the semilunar valves. Heart murmurs. Well, under normal circumstances, the heart makes these nice sounds when they close, but there could be circumstances where there are anatomical changes to these valves, and they're going to make noises at different times or different kinds of noises. All right, so what are some ways that a valve can misbehave? Maybe it doesn't close, so it's a leaky valve, right? Or maybe it doesn't open all the way, right? So there's a couple examples right there, and that will produce abnormal heart sounds when the valves don't work correctly. We just might want to call that a defective heart valve. Sometimes we actually call that an incompetent valve. So an incompetent valve opens completely and closes completely. It doesn't leak. Sometimes the valve disease is congenital. Whoa, what does that mean? A person is just born with an abnormally formed valve, and that could be an AV valve or a semilunar valve, right? But it could also be developmental, which means that you're not born with a defective valve, but it happens over the course of your lifetime.
And one thing that's well known to damage valves is rheumatic fever. And that's because your body fights rheumatic fever by building antibodies, and the antigen on it will bind to a heart valve as well as the organism that produces rheumatic fever. All right, so the antibodies that your body produces, all right, not only fights the Streptococcus infection, but those antibodies also attack the person's heart and kills the valves, deforms the valves. That's what kind of disease is that? Does anybody know what kind of disease that is? That is an autoimmune disease when that happens. And that's really unfortunate. So certainly we want to treat that very, very quickly. Dental caries. What's another name for a dental carie? A cavity. Well, there are some ingenious people that realize that dental caries are due to bacteria. So bacteria will start to metabolize things that are in your diet, particularly sugars, right? And then they'll secrete acid when they metabolize those sugars. That acid then etches out the enamel on your teeth. And that's what we call a cavity or a dental carie. So somebody said, well, guess what? If we get rid of all those bacteria that are there, then no one will ever have a cavity again. So how do we get rid of those bacteria? By giving a vaccine to somebody, right? And so they did some tests. They developed a vaccine to Streptococcus mutans, lactobacilli bacteria. And they found in animal models, when that vaccine was given to some animals, those animals developed antibodies that attacked the heart, and it killed the heart. So that's unfortunate. So the studies never progressed to the human phase, because we could protect you from cavities, but what would you have to give up to have that nice protection? You would have to give up your heart, right? So, or all the valves. You'd have to get mechanical valves in all different places of your heart. That's probably not a good choice, right? So no one has ever done that. Okay. Mitral stenosis is when a valve doesn't open all the way. And in particular, what valve for mitral stenosis? Yeah, what's another name for mitral valve? Bicuspid, right on the left side of the heart. It becomes so thick and there becomes calcified, right? There's little calcium deposits build up on it. And so that impedes the flow. And have you ever blown up a balloon, put a lot of air in it, and just let a little bit of air escape from the balloon? Does it make a little sound? Yeah, what kind of little sound? Yeah, exactly. Somebody made a little squeaking sound someplace. I don't know where it came from. All right. And so that would be a heart murmur too, not because the valve doesn't close, but because it doesn't open completely. Right. And so all of these valves, if they're not working properly, we say they are incompetent. All right. So that can happen. Other heart sounds can happen due to other kinds of abnormalities in the heart. Well, let's see. What do we have here? Two different kinds of abnormalities in the septum with between chambers inside the heart. Can you remember how many septa there are in the heart? There's an interatrial septum between the atria, and there's an interventricular septum between the ventricles. And in the normal individual, at least in an adult, there should be no holes in either of these walls between these chambers. Right, so here is the first case right here. I see that there is a hole in the interatrial septum between the right atrium and the left atrium. So the left atrium goes all the way over here, but it's behind the pulmonary artery and the aorta. All right, so here's a hole. So blood can flow from the right atrium into the left atrium, and when it does that, what organ is it going to bypass? And it's a nice organ that you would like to utilize all the time. Okay. If blood goes into the left atrium, that means it's not going into the right ventricle, and it's not going to where? The lungs, right? So your blood is not becoming oxygenated if it takes this little side trip over here. So in a fetus, that's absolutely normal, because does a fetus use their lungs? A fetus is somebody that hasn't been born yet. Does a fetus use their lungs? No. So there's no sense in having a lot of blood go to a fetal lung, because there's no oxygen there to pick up anyway. So there is a normal hole in the heart. We call that, anybody remember what that hole was called? Fossa is a depression. A hole is a foramen. So it's called the foramen, and you got the last part of that word right. Yeah, ovale. Foramen ovale. So as a fetus, you have a foramen ovale. That's normal. Okay, but when you're born, that foramen should close over, and it's not as quite as thick as the rest of the atrial septum, so it feels like a little depression. Right? And then, so the foramen ovale becomes the fossa ovalis, but sometimes it doesn't close over, and it's actually fairly frequent, and then it becomes what we call a patent foramen ovale. Right? Foramen ovale is what a fetus has. An adult shouldn't have that, but if there is one, then blood can go through, which means that it's a patent vessel, right, or patent passageway. It's open, something can move through it, and it would be a foramen ovale. And if it's just a small hole, people can live a pretty normal life. They can get into their 40s, maybe even 50s before their heart starts to fail, and they notice that. All right, so it would not be uncommon for somebody here in the room to have a PFO. And maybe sometime in 10 years, 20 years from now, you might have to get that repaired. Right? That should be closed. All right, so that's interatrial septal defect. But you could have a defect in the interventricular septum. Right? And here I see which way is blood flowing. And so blood is going to flow when these ventricles contract, pretty much. Right? And it's always going to flow in one direction. So how does blood flow? What moves blood from one place to another? Pressure. It always goes from high pressure to low. And so does that explain why blood always goes from the left ventricle to the right ventricle? Why is that? Because the pressure in the left ventricle goes up to 120 millimeters of mercury. But what's the maximum pressure in the right ventricle? Yeah, maybe 25. 25, right? So blood is always going to go from high pressure to low pressure, and it's going to make a noise when that happens. And that's really easy to see on certain kinds of imaging techniques, especially MRI techniques. Okay, so that's something about that part of the heart. Well, electrical activity of the heart. The heart's a muscle, and just like skeletal muscle, there has to be depolarization, and that's going to open up calcium channels, right? And that calcium in the heart is going to bind to a molecule that's going to allow cross-bridge cycling. What's that molecule within a sarcomere of the heart that calcium has to bind to in order to get the sliding of the filaments? It's troponin. Yeah, it's troponin, right? And when calcium binds to troponin, tropomyosin gets out of the way, and there can be cross-bridges between actin and myosin. Okay. So, the heart contracts as a unit, and that's because there are electrical synapses between all the cells. And remember, an electrical synapse is due to gap junctions, which is just a little hole in the cell membrane. Don't have a picture of it, but we looked at it already. So that if sodium increases in one cell, then it's going to diffuse into the next neighboring cell. And when the sodium diffuses into the neighbor cell, what happens to the electrical properties or the cell membrane potential of the neighboring cell when sodium diffuses in? It depolarizes. And what do you know about depolarization? Is it excitatory or doesn't do anything to the cell or does it hyperpolarize? It depolarizes the cell. And you know depolarization to be an excitatory event, right? So when sodium diffuses into a neighboring myocardial cell, it causes depolarization and contraction of neighboring cells. So all you have to do is depolarize one cell in the heart, and guess what happens? All the cells depolarize, which means that they should all contract. All right, but remember, between the atria and ventricles, I didn't talk about it today, but I'm sure you're aware of this, there is a fibrous part of the fibrous skeleton between the atria and the ventricles, and that is connective tissue. The fibrous skeleton doesn't allow for action potentials to move across from the atria to the ventricles. So that means that the atria are electrically isolated from the ventricle, and that causes the atria to contract a little bit before the ventricles. Both atria contract followed by both ventricles. So there is only one pathway that electrical signal can get through this fibrous skeleton, and we see it on this slide right here. All right, so I see a nice heart. We see all four chambers. right at on the superior part of the right atrium, near the orifice to the superior vena cava, there is some special cardiac muscle tissue. Right? And it's not really responsible for contracting, but it depolarizes spontaneously in a rhythmic fashion. And when it depolarizes, what happens? Remember, only one cell has to depolarize, and then what happens? Depolarization moves through all of these cells of the heart, causing contraction. Right? So we call this the sinoatrial node. This controls the heart rate, or the rate at which the heart is going to contract. All right, so it depolarizes. Depolarization moves over both atria, including through the atrial septum, but it can't get through the fibrous skeleton between the atria and the ventricles. So that means then that the atria would become uncoordinated with the ventricles. But here's the pathway. I see some more yellow on this slide. This is what we call the atrioventricular node. And again, it's some specialized muscle, some specialized cardiac muscle, but this muscle right here doesn't conduct. It's there because it will accept that depolarization from the atria and hold on to it for maybe a tenth of a second, a quarter of a second, and then it will send the signal through the atrioventricular bundle, and this is how the electrical signal gets through the fibrous skeleton. Right through this region here. Then it gets into the interventricular septum, and there are branches. These are what we call bundle branches, and that electrical impulse then goes very quickly down to the apex of the heart, and it spreads out to the rest of the myocardium via these Purkinje fibers. And that causes the ventricles to contract. So the atria contract first due to depolarization of the sinoatrial node. Right, they contract, and that causes depolarization of the rest of the conduction system of the heart, which then causes the ventricles to contract, especially these more apical regions of the heart depolarize first because signals just move down through the septum to the apex before they get to Purkinje fibers. So does that make sense to you? Atria should contract first. Why is that? Because they're responsible for pumping blood into the ventricles. Right, so they should contract a little bit before the ventricles in order for that to happen. And the second question is, why should the apical region contract before these basal regions? Because if the basal region contracted before the apex, which way would blood be pushed? From the base down into the apex, and if it got into the apex, where would it go? No place. There's no place to go. Right? So the apex contracts a little bit before the basal region, and so that forces blood from this apical region up to the basal region, and that's where the semilunar valves are. So that helps pump blood out of the heart. All right, so the sinoatrial node also has another name. Sometimes we call that the pacemaker of the heart. So we said that it depolarizes spontaneously. Here is a nice graph of voltage versus time. And so these almost look like action potentials. And right here is a threshold voltage. And I see here is something that looks like a stimulus. But this right here in the nodal tissues in the heart is due to a slow trickle of sodium entering the cells. And sodium can enter cells in nodal tissue because they have something called an HCN channel. It's a sodium channel. And that allows for sodium to enter the cell at a constant rate. They never close. The HCN channels never close. So sodium is always entering these nodal cells. And when sodium enters, because these HCN channels are there, what happens to the membrane potential? It starts to depolarize, just spontaneously. And when it reaches threshold, right, then what happens? Well, there's this action potential from nodal tissue because then calcium channels open up. Calcium enters the cytosol, and that causes a massive depolarization, right? And this depolarization then can eventually lead to contraction of the myocardium. And then here is repolarization. What kind of channel are you familiar with in terms of repolarization? Potassium, right? So potassium is going to leave the cell. That causes repolarization. When it gets down to resting membrane potential again, does it look like this nodal tissue just sits at resting membrane potential? Does it sit here for a long period of time? No, only that one little instant in time, because In the membrane, there are those sodium channels that never close. So sodium starts to leak into the cell. It causes this depolarization. And when it reaches threshold once again, then you get an action potential that causes contraction. All right, so I do want you to be able to recognize this graph as an action potential from a nodal cell or a conductive cell in the heart. Could you tell that this is not a nerve fiber by this depolarization? Yeah, probably, because you drew an action potential in lab, right? You saw that there's no spontaneous depolarization. Depolarization probably is a little bit faster, right? And then repolarization happens, and then, okay, there's a long period between the next action potential. Okay. All right, so every cell has these HCN channels in it, but it's only the SA node that has many of them. So the SA node depolarizes faster than any other kind of muscle in the heart. And since it depolarizes faster and produces this action potential, it controls activity of the whole heart. Right. If something happened to this SA node, then a pacemaker would develop in some other location inside the heart because they all have these HCN channels, but it would be at a slower rate. Right? So the SA node works because the slope of this pacemaker potential right here is relatively steep. It has the highest, the SA node has the highest rate of depolarization due to these HCN channels. Okay, so other tissues, like I said, will spontaneously depolarize. And as a matter of fact, the heart does not need innervation to contract. Right? It becomes excited, it reaches threshold without any kind of nerve signal. And so if we were to take my heart out, put it on the table right here, right? No nerves connected to it, what would it do? Would it just sit there? Would it just sit there? It would actually contract, right? Because of those nodal tissues inside the heart would depolarize and it would contract, just like what movie? You saw it for sure. Raiders of the Lost Ark. Okay, so you saw this happen already, so we could take that heart, put it back in me, and everything would be fine, right? Okay, so a heart contracts all by itself. Due to these, what kind of proteins in the membrane that allows the heart to contract all by itself? It's the HCN channels, right, in the cell membrane. So there are nerves that go to the heart. Okay, and so what kind of nerves go to the heart? Is it somatic, motor neuron, or an autonomic neuron? Autonomic, that's right, because you can't change your heart rate, right? You can only voluntarily control skeletal muscle. Okay. I think we talked about that already. Well, does this look like this kind of action potential here? Here's the first action potential that we're going to talk about. Here's the second one. Okay, do they look the same? The second one here has this big long plateau region. So the second action potential that we see is much longer before it completely repolarizes. So this kind of action potential is not from a nodal cell, right, or from a nodal tissue. This is from a muscle cell that's actually responsible for contraction. So here's an action potential from a contractile cell. So what happens here? Well, when it receives that action potential from the pacemaker, that opens up voltage-gated channels for sodium. Sodium rushes inside the cell. We know that to be depolarization. That's excitation. That's going to allow calcium to flood from outside the cell to inside the cell, but also calcium from endoplasmic reticulum to the cytosol. And that's going to allow the cross bridges to form, right, because of tropomyosin and troponin, all that stuff you know about already, right? But instead of repolarization taking place right away, there's another kind of protein in the membrane of these contractile cells, and it's a calcium channel, right? During depolarization, these calcium channels open up, and where's calcium at a high concentration that you know of? Inside the cell or outside? Outside the cell, right? So when these calcium channels open, do they hyperpolarize or depolarize? Calcium rushes in, it's a cation, it causes depolarization. And that calcium, as it's rushing in, maintains the state of depolarization. Some potassium channels do open up, which has a tendency to
repolarize the membrane, but mostly what's happening here is influx of calcium, and it maintains this, what we call plateau region, and then these calcium channels close, and then finally the predominant effect is due to potassium leaving the cell because the potassium channels haven't closed. Okay, so what can you tell me about, so this is an action potential, but what can you tell me about an action potential? Can they summate? Can one happen on top of another? They cannot, right? So because myocardial cells have this long plateau region right here, it means that the heart can only contract for a short period of time, and it has to relax once again before it can contract, which means that a heart can't go into tetanus. Unlike skeletal muscle can go into complete tetanus, it can cramp up, right? But the heart can never do that because of these calcium channels that are in the plasma membrane. So this is what we call, what, the absolute refractory period. So the absolute refractory period of a contractile cell in the heart is really long because why? Because of these calcium channels, calcium entering the cytosol. And of course, then it certainly can bind to troponin, tropomyosin, right? But remember, these action potentials cannot summate. All right, so can you tell me the difference between an action potential in a nerve compared to an action potential in a nodal cell compared to a contractile cell? So you should be able to compare and contrast these different action potentials and know some membrane proteins that are responsible for their different behaviors. And why is it important to have these behaviors? Like, for instance, why is it very adaptive to have contractile cells not be able to go into tetanus? Why is that? Why is that a good thing? So tetanus means that the heart would contract, right? Why is it a good idea not to be able to allow the heart to stay contracted? Because it's not pumping blood when it is in systole. What does it have to do first? It has to relax. It has to fill with blood before it contracts again, right? So there's got to be two phases for the heart to work properly. And if it goes into tetany, there's only one phase and the heart won't pump any blood. And when the heart's not pumping any blood, how long can you maintain consciousness? How long can you maintain consciousness? Remember, your brain needs ATP. That's right. When your heart stops pumping blood, you have 2 to 3 seconds of consciousness, and that's it. And if your heart doesn't start pumping blood again over a certain period of time, brain is going to die. What period of time does the brain die if the heart is not pumping? Yeah, 2 to 3 minutes once again, right? So it is a really good idea that the heart cannot go into tetanus because we'd all be passing out all the time, right? I'm sure all of us have had muscle spasm or muscle cramps in skeletal muscle and even smooth muscle, but cardiac muscle can't do that. Okay. So we looked at the pattern of conduction through these nodal tissues. We talked about the delay through the AV node. Okay. And we know a lot about excitation-contraction coupling. It's almost the same as in skeletal muscle. Cardiac muscle does have troponin and tropomyosin. It's just that where calcium comes from is a little bit different. For skeletal muscle, it comes almost exclusively from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, but in cardiac muscle, it's partly sarcoplasmic reticulum and partly extracellular because of the calcium channels that are in the plasma membrane. This just shows us the absolute refractory period is very long because the action potential for a contractile cell in the heart is very long in duration because of this plateau due to calcium channels that are open. Okay? And that means that the heart can't go into tetanus. So if we look at an action potential from a contractile cell and compare it to the ECG, remember we said ECG is just a measurement of electrical activity on the surface of our body, so it's measuring the electrical activity of millions and millions and millions of heart cells, right? And all of those cells add up to produce a voltage. It's pretty easy to measure on the surface of our body, right? P, QRS, and T wave. And how that corresponds to an action potential from a contracting cell is shown on this diagram, right? So can you tell that this is a contractile cell? in the heart and not a nodal cell? How could you convince me this is from a contractile cell and not a nodal cell in the heart? Because of the plateau right here, right? And I don't see spontaneous depolarization, right, which then will control the heart rate. Right? I just see this plateau on this action potential, so I know it's from a contractile cell. So what is this first phase of the action potential called? What is this first phase called? That's called depolarization. And when does that happen in the ECG? During the QRS complex. So what did we say? What does the QRS complex do to? Depolarization of the ventricles. Right? And so here we see depolarization of one cell, but let's put millions and millions of cells there. It's going to produce this QRS complex. All right, and then you're probably wondering, why is the T wave way over here? And that's because of this long plateau in the action potential for a contractile cell. So here is repolarization of this one cell, but remember there's millions and millions and millions. All those electrical signals can add up, right? By the time it gets to the surface of the body, it produces the T wave. So T wave is due to ventricular repolarization, and the QRS is due to ventricular depolarization, specifically of the contractile cells. Okay, so make sure you can answer those questions. This shows, well, we looked at this already. What this shows is the pattern of depolarization and repolarization of the atria and the ventricles. All right, so where does depolarization happen first? Ventricles or atria? And both atria or one atrium in particular? One, because that's where the SA node is, right? So this is where depolarization happens first. And it flows over both atria, causes them to contract, right? And I don't see any depolarization in the ventricles. Why is that? And that's because of the fibrous skeleton. Those action potentials can't get across the fibrous skeleton. They are in the AV node, but that holds on to the signal for a short period of time. Wow, you might have to take the battery out of that thing. Okay, so then the AV node lets go of that signal, it goes down through the septum down to the apex, and then the apical regions start to depolarize first, which means what? They start to contract, right? And that depolarization then occurs over all of the ventricles causing contraction, and there's probably a third color on here someplace showing what? Repolarization. Okay, so is this color different than this one down here? Oh, wow. Okay, it looks exactly the same to me. All right, well, you will make more sense of that. So guess what? We still have to talk about some blood vessels next time. But I want you to know the anatomy of blood vessels, look at the different kinds of capillaries, because guess what? You really know all that stuff already from anatomy. And so I think I only have one more slide to talk about in this chapter. Okay, sign the sign-in sheet, please.